This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Hypnosis has been used as a technique to stop smoking, improve athletic and academic performance, control pain, and quell anxiety. But hypnosis has had a murky reputation. It's also been used as a party trick or a form of entertainment, with practitioners using hypnotic techniques to get members of their audience to embarrass themselves in front of others. And it's been called into question as a method for uncovering memories of childhood abuse. My guest, therapist David Kaloff, uses hypnosis in his private practice to explore and understand the world of the unconscious and as a potential stepping stone to mental health and healing. Kaloff is the co-author of The Couple Who Became Each Other, about some of the families and couples he's treated. I spoke with David Kaloff last year. Since hypnosis has been around for centuries, I wondered why it continues to be a questionable approach to therapy.
Well, you're correct. It's always had a mixed reputation. Sometimes it's been more in favor, sometimes less. In particular, it came back into favor in modern history after the World Wars, when it was used as a short-term solution for what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, but what, of course, they called then battle fatigue. And so it gained favor. And then in the mid-50s, both the American and the British Medical Associations approved it as a bona fide treatment modality. Then since then, it's come in and out of favor. And I think some of the reasons for that are that it's sort of, in an archetypical kind of way, reminds us all of the unknown. We think about hypnosis as probing the depths of the unconscious and perhaps finding out things about ourselves that we'd rather not know or rather not experience. I think that's one of the reasons. I think the other reason is that it has a bad rap in terms of kind of the modern connotation of it is that it's an operator doing something to a subject, that we're overpowering the subject. And of course, you know, no one would want to submit to something like that. And then lastly, and I think this is perhaps a reason in the professional community, is that not everybody is trained in it. And I know that people in the professional community tend to eschew that which they're unfamiliar with. So I think all those factors probably conspire to some extent.
Well, I think it's important for us to talk about how hypnosis works and how you can use hypnotic techniques to activate and get to the unconscious. Let's begin at the beginning. And again, this is probably from movies and television shows. What we see then is the hypnotherapist then telling their subject to think about something or to focus on something. Why is that important to begin the hypnotic trance?
Well, in general, inductions do begin with almost always with some kind of focal point. And the only purpose for that really is to simply concentrate the attention so that there's less attention to extraneous things and more attention to simply the task at hand. In a therapeutic setting, that, of course, would be the objective to be achieved. And so all you're really doing is trying to reduce outside input.
But what happens then when you begin to focus? What happens to that outside world?
Well, it tends to go away. The person in hypnosis will say, depending upon the depth of hypnosis, but generally will say, you know, I knew there were things happening around me. I could hear the traffic noises, could hear the sounds in the room, but they really didn't matter to me. Really in the same way that you and I are concentrating right now. We're really tuned into each other, into the questions and the responses, and less concerned with what's happening in the room around us. That kind of concentration is very much the same.
Is it also the same kind of trance you can enter as a driver? You get into your car, you hop on the highway, and half an hour later, you arrive at your destination. You have absolutely no conscious idea about how you got there.
You got it exactly. As a matter of fact, that's been known as highway hypnosis.
And I guess, the question is, where does your mind go then under those circumstances? We know where we aren't. Where are we?
Well, I think what it does is it allows us access to sort of non-linear, non-conscious ways of thinking. It allows us access to, you know, past learnings, to past associations. The mind and the unconscious works in a more circular fashion, so our logic isn't bound by straight lines. For example, if I asked you as a conscious process to tell me to name your most favorite piece of music in the world, and to only do that with your conscious mind, it would literally be impossible because the computing task would be enormous. You'd have to compare every piece of music you'd ever heard to every other piece of music you'd ever heard. It would take forever. unconsciously, you can tell me in the flash of an eye. And the reason is because it isn't bound by linear kinds of logic. We can synthesize an awful lot of data unconsciously, almost instantaneously. So it's sort of, the answer is, where do we go? It's kind of like, if you quiet, then you're more able to hear that still voice inside, those intuitions, that imagery that floats through your mind, more or less the products of the unconscious.
Why, though, is there this division? Why is certain material then in the unconscious that we can only get through either through perhaps dreams or hypnosis or daydreaming or, you know, a piece of music that can take you back to the 60s when you heard it for the first time?
Exactly. Well, there's probably two major reasons for that bifurcation. One is that some information in there we simply don't need to have. And if I can just tell you a brief little story to illustrate that. You may have heard the story of the frog and the centipede. And the frog had watched the centipede for years walking, and he was marveled by this. He couldn't understand how this creature could coordinate the movement of 100 legs all at once. He felt so inadequate with his four legs. So one day he approached the centipede, and he says, "You know, I've been watching you." And he says, "I have no idea how you walk. How is it that you know which legs to pick up and which ones to put down and which ones to swing at which times?" And the centipede said, "You know, that's a great question. No one's ever asked me that before. Let me think on it." So he strained and he strained and he strained, and he finally says, "You know, I don't know." And with that, he turned to walk away and fell over. And so the idea there is that some things are simply left better at the unconscious: how we walk, when to take a breath, you know, when the body needs sleep. Many things are simply best left to that computer, if you will. That's one of the reasons.
Well, if we're talking then about hypnosis, and we've gotten that person then to focus on something, make that outside world go away, how then does a hypnotherapist work with a subject, with a patient?
Well, there's many different ways to do that, obviously. In general, the kind of orientation that I have, and really very much the orientation of modern hypnotherapy, is different than the old notion. The old notion was that somehow or another you were deficient in certain kinds of suggestions, or you had too many of a kind of suggestion. So we would, figuratively speaking, open your head up, take out the bad suggestions, and put in good ones. Now, on occasion, we still do that. We might do that for performance issues. For example, the person who's constantly telling themselves, "I'm terrible at math," and then, true to form, you know, flunks the test.
Right.
We might simply point out in hypnosis that they're already doing bad self-hypnosis and literally help them change that input. That's one way of working. But in modern hypnotherapy, we're really more interested in accessing the client's own problem-solving resources. I'll give you maybe more of an example of that. A woman once came to see me who had just been elected to the presidency of a club, and she said, "I can't do this because I can't speak in public." Well, it turned out that she was a performer in the art. She was, in fact, a dancer and was a very skilled dancer. So in hypnosis, I didn't tell her she wouldn't be afraid of public speaking. I simply reminded her she already knew how to perform in front of an audience and how to put her nervousness aside. So she simply translated those skills to the skills of being a speaker, and it worked. So in a sense, that was her problem solving. I didn't add something that wasn't already there. I just helped her evoke a potential she had.
But if you're speaking to someone's unconscious through hypnosis, you have to figure out then what the language, what the metaphors, what the poetry of that of their unconscious world is.
That's really well put, and we do a lot of that. We listen very carefully for, you know, phrases and words that are repeated, for certain kind of personality values. So we're constantly looking for what we call the entry point. What way of talking will they be able to process that will mean something to them and be able to affect change?
But how do you know that you're tapping into their unconscious mind, or maybe they're just faking?
Well, that's always a possibility. And in fact, that's one of the recognized defenses against hypnosis. And there's ways of telling, you know, to a trained observer whether someone is actually simulating or not. There's, I'll give you an example. If someone in a deep trance is told that they don't see a chair in front of them and they're told to walk forward, they will, but they'll walk around the chair. Now, someone simulating will walk into the chair. So there's a number of ways of telling.
Are some people, though, more hypnotizable than other people?
Well, let me answer that question in two parts. Let me break it down. Are there some people who, when we say hypnotizable, generally speaking, we're talking about somebody doing it to them. If we say, can everybody go into a state of hypnosis? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And you gave a beautiful example of that, you know, the highway hypnosis example, or the twilight state of sleep at night, you know, when we're sort of half between awake and asleep. And that's a time, by the way, when we're very suggestible. If we say that tomorrow's going to be a rotten day, generally it is. So anybody can enter into that state. But when you put it into what we call a heterohypnosis context, that is the context of working with another person, then you put all kinds of other relationship dynamics on top of that. So then you're working with more than just the inherent ability of that subject to experience hypnosis. Then you're working with all of the dimensions of an interpersonal relationship. And of course, there can be trust issues, there can be transference issues, there can be any kinds of issues to stand in the way. So it's very possible that someone who has the capacity of going into hypnosis might not work well with me for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Maybe my voice reminds them of a cousin or something they didn't like, but they could walk down the hall and work with someone else and do just fine. So, and then also you asked if there's some people that sort of do this a little bit better.
Yeah.
The more, in terms of personality characteristics, the greater the ability to become absorbed in something, you know, like that highway hypnosis experience, generally speaking, that's a good predictor of a good candidate for hypnosis. On a scale of artist to engineer, although this is an overgeneralization, artists do a little bit better. This is not actually technically correct, but people who use a lot of right brain kind of thinking, mm-hmm. non-linear, artistic, spatial, tend to do better. And then lastly, people who had to dissociate as children, either because of some kind of trauma or, you know, traumatic demand, or sometimes like characteristically the only child who didn't have a lot of external input, so had to create a rich inner world, sometimes that person will also be very adept.
Now, how do you then bring this person out of a hypnotic trance? And how much do they actually then consciously remember what went on?
Well, there's any number of ways of bringing them out. Sometimes you just reorient them to the conversation before the induction of hypnosis. Sometimes we use a count to bring them out. Generally speaking, after the first induction, if we're going to work with the person more than once, then we put in a suggestion that makes future inductions easier. So, for example, in the future, when I count from 1 to 5, you go right back into this state. And that means we can spend more of the time in the session mm-hmm. doing the therapy.
And they literally can learn to do that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and there they are?
Oh, sure. If you don't, that's just simple conditioning. I mean, if you see an 8-sided red sign, chances are your foot wants to go to the brake pedal without any conscious mediation.
Right. We're talking about Skinner here, I guess. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, do they remember, you ask? Well, in general, yes. In general, they do. Most hypnotherapy is done not at the deepest state of hypnosis, what is called the somnambulistic state, somnambulism, which comes from sleepwalking. Most hypnotherapy is not at that state and doesn't need to be. And one of the characteristics of that deep state is spontaneous amnesia. Typically, you don't find that in the more moderate levels of trance, which most hypnotherapy is done in. Now, it's more like when you come out of it, if anyone was rambling on to you for 20 minutes, it would probably be somewhat dreamlike. And so the people say, yeah, I can remember it, but I don't really need to or want to. It's just kind of in the back of my mind, kind of dreamlike. Sometimes the more they focus on it, the more it goes away. And in general, the orientation is to just sort of let it cook in the back of your mind. Don't bring it up and look at it critically.
My guest is therapist David Kaloff. We're talking about hypnosis, the subject of his book, The Couple Who Became Each Other. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. David Kaloff is our guest. He's a family therapist, uses hypnosis in his private practice, and he's also the author of a book called The Couple Who Became Each Other. Is all hypnosis, in the end, self-hypnosis?
That's very well put. And as a matter of fact, I've said that myself over the years. I really believe that's the case. I think that at best, we're facilitators. At worst, we get in people's ways of accessing their own inner resources. But ultimately, the state of hypnosis belongs to the subject. It's a naturalistic state. We go in and out of it our entire lives. All we hypnotherapists learn how to do is to be able to guide someone into that state, stabilize it, and then operate as something of a guide in that state to direct them to their own resources. But I think the best way to think about that is literally that all self-hypnosis, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. I think that's a very well put idea.
The way you talk about the unconscious makes it sound like it's smarter than our conscious life. Is that true? Is that really where some of our important wisdom is?
Yes. It can also be, in its wisdom, it can also be incredibly stupid, and I'll explain what I mean by that. But yes, it's very different than the Freudian notion of the unconscious, which sort of holds it as this amoral, antisocial, you know, has to be herded and controlled kind of force. Our notion of the unconscious is more as this creative resource. Sometimes the creativity, though, can be somewhat silly. An example of that, I remember once a woman consulted me who had horrible pain in her shoulders and these knots of muscles in his shoulders that just wouldn't go away despite many kinds of medical treatments. And when we find in hypnosis, when we finally got to the source of it, she literally said, you know, my boss likes to lump work on me, likes to lump work on my shoulders. Now, So that was a brilliant metaphor. So it was a way for the unconscious to say to her, look, get what's happening here, what we refer to as organ language, language that references organs of the body. Understand that you're taking lumps here. That was brilliant. What was not brilliant, although from the point of view of the unconscious, it was smart, because of this, she couldn't do her job. She couldn't type. So the unconscious was protecting her from this kind of tyrant of a boss. Well, in an adult mind, when she could re-examine that decision, of course, she had other ways of dealing with his stress. She set better limits and negotiated better. So sometimes the unconscious takes these extreme measures.
What's curious, too, is why then it becomes therapeutic and healing to make that unconscious conscious, that somehow putting words to a conflict or words to some kind of emotions brings about some kind of change for the better.
It doesn't always. In fact, sometimes insight does not produce change. When it does work, it's because we can re-examine an earlier decision and we can examine it with the point of view and with the resources that we've garnered in the time since that experience. In other words, a childhood experience can be examined with adult wisdom. In that way, we can change the unconscious because it has new input. But sometimes we don't need to bring that to a conscious level. Let me give you an example of that. I worked with a woman once for 6 months of therapy who had a variety of issues with her father, who had been to some extent abusive with her, and a mother who'd been alcoholic. And we never we talked about that just to get the information. But the way I worked with her was very much in symbolism. We would basically, in the session, induce a state of hypnosis and then tell her to have a dream that would be relevant to the issues at hand. Well, she had a series of dreams, and they were all of a similar theme. They were of doing laundry. And they went in a progression from going to her backyard and seeing all these dirty clothes hanging on her laundry line. That was the first dream, and they're not washed, and she's wondering what they're doing there. As the dreams progress over time, this transmogrifies into a dream in which she sees that her father's dirty underwear is mixed in with hers. Now, it would have been very tempting at that point to interpret that. It would have been tempting to say, well, this is the dirtiness from, you know, the molestation, and you're trying to separate out your identity from your father's. And that would have been correct, but it probably wouldn't have done anything. What we did instead was, in hypnosis, she simply re-scripted the dreams. Hmm. She in the dream, she took down her father's clothes, she washed it, gave it back to him, she took her own clothes down, separated them, and in this process of 6 months of therapy, a very profound depression lifted. We did very little insight.
When you're working with a whole family, do you sometimes hypnotize the whole group?
It can either happen that way or individual members. But yes, I'll sometimes do the whole group. But it does several things. It can be a means of stress management for everybody. It's also, a very intimate experience. You have a, I'll put them in rapport with each other so they're aware of each other's presence in the room. And it can be a tremendous experience of intimacy. You know, it's very, like if you're with a loved one and you're having a wonderful day and there's very few words exchanged, but you feel like there's this rich communication between you nevertheless, it takes on that kind of quality. So yes, it's possible to do that as well as working with individual members.
And sometimes in this family session, do you ask one member of the family to be another member of the family and have them talk to each other?
Well, in some cases, I've done that with siblings before, where they've actually exchanged identities and renegotiated their differences. And then I've also done that, and there's actually the title chapter of the book, The Couple Who Became Each Other, was in fact a couple that had been at horrible loggerheads in their marriage for 5 years, had been to a number of marriage therapists, had failed miserably, and came to see me, and fortunately both were excellent hypnotic subjects with some experience, and so I, in essence, had them become each other. And in that deep trance of being each other, they could call upon their unconscious knowledge of each other, and in the exchange of identities, renegotiated their differences and were very successful.
I'm curious what a whole family in hypnosis looks like.
Basically, it looks like a bunch of people taking a nap. Is what it's not very.
You get paid for this stuff, right?
And I get paid for this stuff. Actually, I'll tell you, it's interesting because there's sort of the loneliness sometimes of the hypnotherapist. Please understand, that's not all that I do.
Right.
But for me, sometimes it's more interesting when I'm more engaged with someone at a more conscious level. It's more, you know, rather than my just simply drolling on and their eyes are closed, I sometimes feel lonely in those moments.
Well, David Kaloff, we are out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air today. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Therapist David Kaloff, co-author of The Couple Who Became Each Other. He'll be giving a lecture on hypnosis and memory at the Exploratorium Science Museum in San Francisco on Saturday, August 29th. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.